work session to order again.
Mayor, I will acknowledge that all are present and in attendance, with the exception of Councilor Woodrow.
Yes, okay. So we have, we're revisiting a transportation system plan at this point, and
she's here.
Oh, there she is.
She's a smart one with coffee. Did you bring enough for everybody?
And not, it's water. But there's water over there. Would you like a glass? I can get you.
No, I'm good.
Okay. Make sure we're ready for the work session. So, for those of you who didn't bring copies, I think everyone should have access to both the transportation system plan and the planning commission recommendation. So, if you can't find those, you can hold them, let me know. We are mostly proceeding same packet as last week, so thanks for having us back to continue the work on the street standards and the motor vehicle parking. I also provided at your seat one of these handouts, so we tried to provide a little bit more information. Couldn't get it in your packet because it was due before we knew that this meeting was going to happen, but there's a handout you can take home with you that has more information about street classifications and also tries to respond to some of the questions that you raised last week. So we'll start with this handout. I think it's helpful to do a little bit of a walk through the types of streets so that when we're looking at the table in the code, we can picture what does that street type look like. So this is pulled directly from the transportation system plan, which is this document, page 38. Major arterials, major and minor collectors, local streets, and alleys. And then if you turn in the transportation system plan, figure 2, which is on page 38, this is what we had talked about a little bit last time. It has all the different street classifications throughout the city on a map. So that will be helpful to look at in thinking about the different types of streets and kind of the purposes that they play in our community. So we're on that 39, I guess, right after page 38, as a pull-out map.
Federal amount.
There you go. We're not used to all this paper in front of us.
We're on the right track.
Page 39. Okay, I'm there.
Okay. And then I pulled out some examples. So if you turn to page 2 of the handout, it starts walking through a couple examples with Street View, which we don't have in our transportation system plan. Yes, I did pull it from Google, so thanks to Google Street View for this. So a minor arterial street classification, an example of that is Centennial Boulevard, so it interconnects and then augments the major arterial system. So major arterial, you can see Highway 126 is our major arterial, and then the yellow streets kind of feed into those. The orange streets are the major collectors, those feed in, the minor collectors feed into that, and then the locals and the neighborhood access, which are really focused on property access, feed up to those larger street classifications. So that's how the system works. So starting with Centennial, you can see that it has bus service running along it, which is typical to have buses running kind of on arterial street systems. And then for each example, there's a cross-section, and this is pulled from the code document, kind of to illustrate one way of laying out that type of street. The next example, major collector street classification type, so Thurston Road is an example of that. It provides both land access and movement within residential, commercial, and industrial areas, what the major collectors achieve, and they gather the traffic from the local streets and kind of feed them up, as I was just explaining. The minor collector classification type, so Oakdale Avenue up in the Gateway area, is an example of that. It provides both land access and movement within residential, commercial, and industrial areas. Not quite as much industrial for this specific case, but that's the type of street and what it's aiming to serve. And then it connects up to the arterials as well. And then I have a local street example down kind of middle Springfield, Douglas Drive, near where Jasper Road and South 32nd is. So that's a local street through the neighborhood. You can see that there's a lot of driveway accesses, houses all along. So that leads us back to this table that we began looking at last time. And there were some comments about minor collectors in particular. Councilor Pishnary was bringing that up. So based on your input, staff started talking about that topic a bit further. This table is establishing kind of the minimum standards. We need to have something that's very clear. That's what this table is for. The section just prior to this in the code says if there is a transportation system plan project that details out more specifics to a specific street, then that would apply instead of this minimum standard. So, for instance, there are some streets in our transportation system plan that have bicycle infrastructure projects that are articulated that may deviate from the standards, but they usually aren't defined in a whole lot of detail. Like Virginia Daisy said there should be a pedestrian and bicycle project along here, but it didn't get into the fine design concept details until we brought it back to council and really did the project development stage. So we haven't gone to that level of planning with some of our planned projects for bikeways. That's something that could be addressed in a pedestrian and bicycle master plan. We talked last week about a separate street standards update project that could get at some of the more nuanced factors. So we're trying to be responsive and would like to help develop a council alternative for minor collectors, if that's the wish of the council, but not get into a whole new planning project that looks at every single street throughout the city of Springfield or all the TSP projects. So one way that we have thought about approaching it is potentially to look at different land uses, and this is something I'd like to check with council and see if this is the direction you'd like to go. So minor collectors, for instance, if you look back on this sheet, Fairview Drive in this West Centennial neighborhood, that is a street where I think it'd be more appropriate to see sharrows on that type of a minor collector.
Appropriate for what? I'm sorry.
For sharrows, the shared lane marking that indicates bikes are more likely to be here. It's a narrower street. There's parking on both sides. It's naturally got some more traffic calming elements. 21st Street is also a minor collector. We have bike lanes on that right now, and it's a bit higher volume. It's more of a regional connector versus a neighborhood circular. And then there's some planned minor collectors up in the North Gateway area with the expansion of the commercial area up there. I think that one approach could be to look at the zoning adjacent to a minor collector and say maybe bike lanes could be more appropriate for a commercially zoned minor collector, which is, you know, accessing office parks. There's peak traffic associated with commuting, that you're not going to see the same dynamic in a neighborhood where it's going to disperse residential traffic. So that's one option. I wanted to see if council would like to go in that direction of commercial versus residential minor collector standards. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Actually, I was going to ask, and perhaps maybe a useful trigger that can be quantified is where you have traffic studies or traffic analysis, where you have trip studies. So where almost regardless of where you're at, you're doing a development that triggers a trip study analysis, then perhaps you can use those numbers to justify having the bike lanes, et cetera, as opposed to, but I'm not sure if that, I don't know at what point to do trip count studies where they're, when they're triggered, but they may already be already way up the chain, you know, the chain of the traffic. But it seems like that if you have a development in North Gateway and you look at those minor connectors between Riverbend Drive and Laura, for example, that they're, I don't know, it's not a street, but it's a street. But it's, so it, you can maybe use those, but I'm not sure if they're would they would even.
Yeah, so we spoke about that, and I think one factor to think about, the Planning Commission actually spoke about several meetings, the topic of traffic calming. If you have a wide, open, straight street, it sends the signal to go fast.
Right.
But if there's high utilization of on-street parking, then that narrows things up. It's being well used, and that encourages people to go slower. So that could be used in situations where we already have a street and we're further developing like a TSP project that says there should be some sort of bikeway on here. But for completely new streets, it's hard to predict their use. If we also looked at the volumes today, but then it connected to areas that are going to have future development and more intensification and more trips generated, then today's volume may not be representative of the future use of that street. But so we started to explore those ideas, and I like the concept.
Right, and, but I'm also looking at it from the an opposite direction, where we have our planner or whoever engineer has got these plans and visions in their mind of what and how things are going. Mm-hmm. But it could be too is that is because when development occurs, these requirements are placed on the developer to pay for these. The city is not paying for them if there's development in the area, so they're based on some engineer's vision. And you know, and I'm not saying it's just autonomy or, you know, in a vacuum, but I'm saying there's a vision out there, and then the build-out is required to be paid by the developer, and then we turn out, and it turns out where it's like, well, there's probably nothing going to happen here in about 40 years. And so, but yet the developers had to pay for the additional street light and additional curbing and additional width, et cetera. So is there a way to go back once we go this way? I mean, is there a way to say, oh, this was not, we should look at this again? Is somebody going to be able to have the ability to say, okay, this no longer makes sense? I mean, I look at the street conceptual map, and there's been decisions made recently that have been good decisions to reverse some of those and accommodate development, which has been great. But is, I just want to know, is when we get into this, how chiseled in stone are they going to be? Is there going to be the flexibility for someone to say this doesn't make sense today?
Yeah, so I think that gets back to the two different projects. There's this project, and we would like to work with council to develop an alternative that's relatively simple, that it fits into this table somehow. And maybe it's a couple different minor collector standards, and one's applied in one location and one's applied in a different location. But then there is the opportunity to have a separate street standard project that really gets into this specific topic.
Okay.
And the ped bike master plan that says, okay, for this street, this project, what should it consist of? What's the design concept beyond, oh, there should be some sort of bike network connection? What does that look like? So more details to come through those processes.
Okay. I'm in the weeds too quick.
I love it. I walk out about this stuff all the time. It's true. So.
I wouldn't doubt it.
So I guess the question zooming out is, does council want us to develop an alternative for minor collectors that has sharrows as a treatment? Do you want to have sharrows be the minimum requirement and kind of see that be all minor collectors? Do you want to differentiate between commercial versus residential in that alternative to put out for public hearing? Do you want us to work on it some more? We can come back in a couple months at our next meeting and share some more ideas. We have only had a week to kind of start talking about it, so.
Sean?
So I think my sense is maybe divide them from a commercial and residential perspective. Because I keep hearing the two projects, and you know, we're kind of getting what we have now sort of codified in a more simple place, and then there's a big discussion behind it that it sounds like about standards. But I think that conversation probably makes sense, right? Because if we can figure out a way to keep the traffic count down, the sharrows are a really good option. But if it's, you know, the traffic's too much, right, people need their own bike lane.
I agree. I think sharrows are very appropriate for the residential areas, et cetera, and the you know, low traffic volumes and lower speeds. And then commercial, I think we're appropriate. It doesn't mean all commercial, but basically when you're going through long strips of commercial property, zone properties and whatnot, that I think that bike lanes make more sense because businesses are going to attract traffic. So they're going to need to have some sort of mitigation of that traffic for the bicycle safety. So I like that.
We can develop an alternative that's along those lines. I think it's also, there's more truck traffic than when you're biking next to trucks. That's a different feeling than a residential area.
Yeah, you got deliveries and you got regular retailing in and out. And
okay, so we will bring that back to you to look at for confirmation.
Leonard.
No, I agree. I think that it makes sense to break it down, I mean, in residential and commercial. What about, this is just a technical consideration, what about mixed use neighborhoods? Do we make those commercial for that purpose?
I depends on what the use is.
I mean, I would advocate for commercial in this case, but.
Sherry?
Yeah, Joe basically said it, you know, I agree, Sean said it as well, that we just divide the two, because there's such two totally different uses on the road, that bikes, you know, and that consideration, is people turning into businesses and that kind of leaving and coming and going, I think definitely should be a totally different consideration, well, not totally different consideration, but a different consideration as far as bike lanes are not, striped or not.
I'll throw a completely different one in there. It's more of a European model, which is you actually stripe your pedestrian bike areas. So you've got a bike lane that's marked with a bicycle, and then you've got two different directions for pedestrians, and you better darn well not get out of your pedestrian lane, because I know people, you know, have commented that you've got a bicycle going by you, but it's still in my mind, it's easier to try and mix bicycles and pedestrians than it is bicycles and cars. So I've always thought we should, you know, you can keep your street and not put the bike lane on the street, but move it into the sidewalk area. And if you have it striped as such, so that, you know, when you are walking, you're not in the same area. I mean, I've got pictures on my phone of what it looks like. And I think you've probably been over where you've seen something similar, and you've seen something similar.
One advantage to that is this. What I've always noticed is having our major streets are streets designed for heavy traffic, and we're having 6 feet on each side for bicycles. Well over designed. If we're to design it, if we're to switch it to pedestrians, it would do a lot less, cost a lot less.
Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about. Is, I mean, I don't know whether that's too big. Oh my gosh, we already have these street designs, but I thought at least for streets like Main Street, where you really need to separate the bicycles. So either we do a Daisy, what's the other street?
Virginia
Daisy variation, where you simply move bicycles completely, they have to go in a couple of blocks, and then they have to go down, and then you come back up, where you have to try and route them completely out of the way, where it's somewhat discouraging, particularly if you're a commuter on a bike. But if you could mix the two, bicycles and pedestrians, and I think you see it because I was on a Washington, D.C. street that had no bike lanes, and they put us on the sidewalk. And that was, I thought, okay, I'm going to kill somebody for sure. But there was plenty of sidewalk, so there's plenty of room to do something like that. So not in all areas, but in some areas where we really struggle to try and figure out a way to protect bicyclists, and they're out on the street with trucks. Is could we look at something that's a variation of that kind of a look, and save some space while we're at it?
No, I just picture that in my head. I've never seen that in it, and the picture in my head is very appealing, and I think it makes a lot of sense. It gets the bicyclists off the road. It's for their safety. The bike lane's for their safety in the first place. And it's like, well, why not make it safer? You have a curb that will help protect them as well. If they're up on the sidewalk, you have a curb that will prevent, you know, accidental drift. I really think that's worth looking into. ORS may be a problem, but have city attorney look at it based on bicycle traffic on the roadways and off the roadways. But I think that's really worth looking at. I know it's kind of late in the game based on these pictures, but I do remember some. Sherry, you were there too when we're doing the Franklin slice, and we're talking about parking, and we're talking about 6 feet of this, another 10 feet of that, and 14 feet of this, and 12 feet of this, and pretty soon you had a 150 foot wide street where we could basically, in this, on that conception, we can eliminate whole planter strips that were there to design for buffer for the bicyclists at that time. So I think it's got a lot of appeal. I really do. I like that. Because you can widen the sidewalk by 3 feet for a lot less money than you can on a street, 3 feet.
I like the creative thinking, and I think these are all great concepts to talk about in the future project that really gets into street details. I've been in Europe, and I can relate to, you know, whether if there's a situation where there's lower speeds, the design approach is very different for that. There's also options to do bi-directional on blocks that don't have driveways as frequently as we typically have here in the U.S., but there's a lot of bike crashes happening in the U.S. that are driveway conflicts. People are riding on the sidewalk. They're going faster than a pedestrian is expected to travel. Someone's backing out the driveway. There's a lot of detail that goes into the engineering of how fast are people moving in the environment? Should it be fully separated? Should it be shared? If so, how? And I think that's a whole separate project that I hope to participate in someday, but it's beyond the scope of this.
But I was thinking of Main Street, just like she is, and there's not a whole lot of pedestrian traffic on Main Street. Anything east of 42nd, there's hardly any pedestrian traffic. But I'm just thinking I don't want it to die tonight. That'd be a good thing to pursue, I think. I like it.
I've got bigger ideas. So back to the bigger question. It sounds like we have a route forward for the council alternative for minor collectors. Is there anything else that you want to discuss with regards to this table 4.2-1, which is establishing the minimum curb-to-curb widths and street right-of-way widths?
So I just have one question, I guess, is this, we know this doesn't impact the roads that exist today out there. Nobody's going to do anything with them, right? So if we think about the world with two projects with a street standards project in there, like this would only be coming to the case where we say break ground on a brand new subdivision or have some, like when we get the UGB expansion.
New streets as well as some frontage improvements. Michael, do you want, or Christina, do you want to speak to?
So I can talk about visibility. As drafted now, these standards would apply in places where there is development that will generate new traffic on a existing substandard city street. So where there are existing streets that don't meet these minimum standards, then assuming that it meets a level of constitutionality, additional right-of-way could be required. Or if the right-of-way is already there, there are a lot of places that there's very wide right-of-way and very underdeveloped streets, it would set the minimum standards of what would need to be either constructed at the time of development or deferred in an improvement agreement for later construction. So it's not the case that it's only when we're breaking ground on new streets.
Okay, thank you.
So everyone's comfortable, you know. Well, I was thinking about the major collector streets, and I was looking at some of the major collectors. I know that on Key Street, you know, there is only parking. I don't even know there's parking on one side. There is no parking, I don't think, along Key Street. Right along. So is that just, you know, is that an exception or, you know, just because it's not necessary because there's enough parking off the...
So the reason you're seeing three different numbers for both the right-of-way and the curb-to-curb width table, or road columns in this table, or that the largest number, the first one, is
like
for when there's parking on both sides.
Right, okay.
The second number is when there's parking on
one side.
And the third number is no on-street parking. So this table, compared to what's in the existing code, helps clarify... What does this number consist of? What makes up the total number? And then it also adds these other smaller components and says, okay, when there's a travel lane, this is how wide it is for this type of facility. So it's trying to clean that piece up and provide clarity.
Thank you. I appreciate the table as opposed to what I was looking at, what you crossed off. You know, this looks much easier to understand.
Yeah, we're very confused.
Which doesn't take a lot nowadays, seems
like.
Yeah,
it doesn't. Not when it's this complicated.
Yes.
We're trying to do our best here in Jordan. This is on in our packet here. Oh, you found it finally.
Yes.
Okay.
On page 14 of this packet.
Yeah. Well, it's page 244 of our packet.
And it's page 14.
14 of the hard copy. Do you want to look in here? 14 of exhibit A.
It's right here.
Yeah, you found it.
I guess one. I mean, numerically, I mean, they look, I guess they look fine, right? But the question I keep coming into, like the situation from a development perspective that I would be concerned about is, we have redevelopment, right? Somehow it shows back up, and this table produces a result that is, that a reasonable person would look at and go, that's not what we want. And I can't think of anything that's in my head, you know, where I go, you know, at this corner, it's not going to work correctly. But when we write tables like this, right, when it, I guess, breaks, the outcome kind of looks like, okay, there's a road here. By the time we require you to upgrade the street standards, essentially you don't have enough room to essentially build the building that you're looking for. So, like, how, like, have you guys given more thought to that? Is there inherently flexibility in that is sort of like what happens when we get that situation?
So I can answer that in a couple different
sure.
ways. So one is that there are exceptions to this table that Emma's mentioned previously
right.
that some developments might want to take more advantage of. The master plan process is one of them that would not require like comprehensive planning to accomplish. So if a large scale developer wanted to use the master plan process, then standards and criteria under that could be used to reach a different result than here. So some of those more creative and location-specific solutions could happen through a master plan. The second thing is that there is a variance process that's in the code to adjust through a minor variance, any standard up to 30% of the numerical value, and there are specific criteria there. It generally requires a condition that's not the property owner's own making. So usually topographical restraints or existing development in the way is another example of a place where variance could be appropriate. That's the two areas. And then the last check on it is constitutionality. In places where there is not right-of-way that has been dedicated, we cannot exact right-of-way that's in excess to rough proportionality of the extent of development. So if you have a I think the best example was if you had a single family zoned lot, very small, in an area where this doesn't actually occur in the city, but hypothetically, there's a minor arterial that was very sub right of way and sub improved. It would not be constitutional to tell a single family developer you have to give the city and right of way half of your lot, and then therefore you don't have enough left to build a house because
right.
we have right of way standards. So that's kind of the last check on that.
And maybe I'm thinking of this mainly from a transportation perspective, and you know, it's like we have to overlay all those, I guess, outlets that happen in the planning process that kind of get you out of those sort of bad results and back into something that's reasonable. Okay.
So, I'll go back and use the example of the apartments that just got built next to me. It required a street. It was $300,000 to do the street. To get the number of units they wanted in there, they must have wanted to offset with some on-street parking. So now there's more sidewalk, there's new lights, and so there is a percentage of a few spaces that are on-street parking, but what they also gave up was the community room and the pool. So the entire apartment complex that was supposed to have a community room and a pool now is all apartments because I'm sure they went, I cannot make this pencil out if now that this, because the street costs so much that I have to build where I was going to put in some resident amenities. I can't do that. So that's what I want to avoid, is that we do that kind of planning. So that we make it something impossible, because I know that was an issue to begin with. I know how much the street is because I heard from the developer, because I literally was in my backyard. So when they had to put in that street, then this was the trade-off.
So on the other hand, I think, you know, we have a lot of undeveloped streets and with develop residential there already, and we didn't enforce development of the street, you know, I think about 17th. So, you know, I'm assuming that the street looks good that they put in, and the sidewalks and the lights and everything are a positive, you know, they've contributed to the community, the street, the area, is that, or not?
I don't think there's any actual stormwater system.
No.
There.
But, and that was one of the things that somebody else said, they paid for it for years, but they thought, oh yeah, okay, we can relate to that.
Well, and I think that many of the streets, they weren't actually part of the city.
Right.
When the housing was built.
When the houses
were built. They were in the county.
Right.
So, but so they're in sewer now, but that's the only upgrade
right.
that they have.
But, you know, I think that going forward, I'm encouraged that we would, you know, we do need to have a plan and flexibility. I think you mentioned there were variances and flexibility involved a little bit in this, so we're not, you know, putting it in stone, hopefully in concrete or blacktop or something. So, you know, I guess a balance is what I would like to see, and I thought, I mean, I feel like by giving some, you know, there is a little bit of flexibility and balance in here, or is there not? Am I reading this correctly?
There is more than the existing code. It is
right.
a step in that direction,
right.
where
okay.
there's more options.
Right. Well, that's what I'm kind of hearing and seeing here.
I'd like to maybe ask another question in relation to this table. So question 2B, it's on page 245, if you're following on the iPad. Question 2B in the communication briefing memo.
In the package, sorry.
In tonight's council session.
Yeah, yeah, all right.
Not your fun stack of papers.
I'm back with you.
What number is that? 2B, question 2B.
And it's on what page?
On page 245 on the iPad.
245 on the iPad.
Okay. So the question is, are the Planning Commission's recommended changes sufficient to provide assurance that the standards in Table 4.2-1, this table, will not trigger additional right-of-way dedication for Main Street? So we heard from several comments were received as part of this project from Main Street property and business owners. Concerned about potential right-of-way impacts specific to Main Street. They were looking at this table, they were looking at the cross-section saying, hey, is there a concern here? Is this part of Main Street safety? What's going on? And asking questions. Planning Commission recommended adding text to the section just prior to the table that says, you know, the transportation system plan, if there's a specific adopted plan for a street, that applies. And then they also added footnote 5, if you can scroll down. And footnote 5 says arterial streets that are Oregon Department of Transportation facilities, such as Main Street is, are not subject to the standards in Table 4.2-1, but must meet ODOT design standards. And then they also verbally responded to the comments, explaining that there is a separate Main Street safety project, which all of you are very familiar, having done a work session last week on it, to determine the future design layout specific to Main Street. And I wanted to let you know that there were several comments provided. This has come up in the Planning Commission hearing process. And just wanted to bring it forward and see, do you want to do a council alternative, or are you feeling good with that response?
How's everybody feeling?
Okay, so basically it's just response, it's whatever they're doing, they have to conform with ODOT's design standards, minimum standards. I don't know how we can argue that.
Yeah, I mean, it's
much
state standard,
like
right?
Argue with ODOT, but it's not going to be any good.
Right.
Unless we want to take it over. For free.
No, thank you. No, thank you.
Put enough zeros on the check, we'll talk, but...
Yeah, that ain't happening.
But I think that's running into the challenge we're having with this overall project, which is that sort of just clarity of what's actually happening and what's actually, we're actually changing. I'm fine with that answer.
So I
think it's just recognition as we go through the public comment process. People are going to go, okay, as you're cleaning this up, what exactly are you changing? How does it impact me?
So the options are that we would support
what
they
exist.
Okay.
And I guess I'm fine with putting these numbers out to public comment. Like, I don't see anything where, you know, as I start to think about the table as a whole, and I'm going, okay, there's something here that I don't necessarily like. I think we gave you guys a couple of changes, but, like, I think that's a good place to start.
Okay, thank you. With that, I think we can move on to 2C, which is right afterwards. So still on page 245 is where it starts. You brought up private streets, so should there be different standards for private streets, and if so, what should they consist of? So, for private streets, once again, it's, you know, do you want to develop, actually, in this situation, it's a little bit different. So having brought this item up, council asked for flexibility in those redesign standards in private streets. Staff started to look at this, and we recommend either deleting the private streets standards as currently written because they're not being applied, or changing them and developing a council alternative. So currently, for singularly owned developments, do you have the page, sorry, Exhibit A, page 33, 34. For singularly owned development, which is what the first section of the private streets language here refers to, so section A says, let's copy it into your packet as well on the next page on 246. The whole private street section is right there. So private streets are permitted within mobile home manufactured dwelling parks and singularly owned developments of sufficient size to permit interior circulation. Construction specifications for private streets shall be the same as for public streets. So this section A right now hasn't been applied because in those situations where manufactured dwelling park or an apartment complex is going in, staff have been deferring to the driveway standards in the code instead. So either we want to further develop this private street section with council direction, or it doesn't make sense to have that section A since it hasn't been applied, and that's an opportunity to simplify the code. With private streets, if there is a standard to exist, then there's no presumed public access on private streets, so that's something to consider. For instance, a development could be built in a gated community with private streets. We could look at, you know, public access easements overlay of the streets. That could be something to consider. The development would need to coordinate with fire, police, and utilities for access. And then the situation also plays into the street connectivity conversation. Do you want to have Springfield residents able to access all the streets throughout the city of Springfield? Do you want to have private streets? If so, what are you looking for in that private street so that we can develop a section of the code that actually meets what your desired outcomes are and what you're looking for?
So right now, we don't apply. What do we apply in, say, a mobile home park or an apartment?
Driveway standard. So it's a circulation within a singularly owned
But a driveway property. Standard, it's like we're looking at it, it's like just one big long driveway.
Do you
want to
say more on that?
Yes. is the short answer. So if we're looking at like an apartment building, a large apartment building or something like that, we kind of consider kind of how Eugene kind of considers it as more of a driveway kind of street. Anything that has like a 90-degree parking coming off into it or something like that. And we would really look at what the minimum width for fire would be and some of those amenities for that. Our multi-unit standards would require some pedestrian considerations as well, but it wouldn't be as, you know, you could have your parking backing out into this private driveway and then fronting a sidewalk. It's not the same full standard, which was more meant for single low-density houses on their own lots, not all sharing the same lot for access to whatever their residence is. That makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Joe.
So back up just a little bit. You said on that is that applies to a single tax lot or on multiple lots that could be independently owned?
Just a single tax lot. When you're talking about like an apartment building or mobile home, it's the mobile home doesn't own the spot that
right.
they're on mostly. And so when you're a low density residential, we have a requirement that you have to have access to that lot either by an easement or the right of way, which is kind of what Emma was getting at with the overlaying it with an easement. so that's meant not to landlock a parcel.
Right.
But when you're in a mobile home park and you're, all these lots are not owned by you, there's a little bit different sense. Same thing as kind of an apartment building and the driveways that go around in an apartment building. Most of the time, people don't own their individual apartment or row house. And so that's kind of the difference here. I think the difficulty with the language here kind of, it would imply that for a mobile home park or even for an apartment building, we had to build this standard, which doesn't really go along with that development type.
Well, I think I support having the driveway standard for those types of properties. I think it to put a street or city street standard on those type of properties is way overkill. Plus, I think it also takes a ton of property to be able to get to street standards, because I think even the smallest one requires sidewalks, and many mobile home parks do not have sidewalks because they're space constricted, and most people walk down the middle of the driveway anyway. So I would support having just going with the driveway standard in those type of properties and not impose the street standard. Yes?
Christina, I just wanted to make a minor clarification on what Michael said. It could be multiple tax lots, but they would be all under single ownership. So there's not a criteria that all of the property be consolidated into one tax lot. So I just wanted to clarify that. So some large apartment complexes are actually three or four tax lots that have been developed
together. Plus you get into the independently owned condominium type, they start converting over to condominium properties and actually start to own that property that's sellable real estate. But in those driveways for the fire still have the weight restriction accommodations that they can have fire truck apparatus.
They need to be able to take an 80,000 pound load. Okay. So they need to prove that whatever section they have of asphalt and rock or concrete and rock can make it so that the fire truck doesn't break it up or get stuck in a pothole or something.
So we're not imposing that next to fire or coffee kiosks either? I say that because it was.
I know. I heard
strictly hypothetically.
No, it's not hypothetical. It was. Yeah. So we're abandoning that part, right?
If it's not a fire access apparatus required roadway, we'd be looking for some standard in terms of our paving requirement for circulation within a parking area.
Yeah.
But in terms of emergency vehicles, there have been scenarios where we don't have the full 80,000 pound load because it's not something that the fire would have to.
I can't let that go for some reason. I'm sorry.
That's okay. But we would want to fulfill the other parts of the code for the requirement of dust-free asphalt.
That makes sense. I totally endorse that. I'm just being silly, I suppose.
Sean, and then Leonard.
Yes, 40 years from now, we'll be sitting around talking about that one coffee kiosk. I'm fine with the using the driveway standards, and under that scenario, I think this section can just go away.
Mm-hmm. Leonard.
This sounds like a silly question. Is there a speed limit in the driveway standard?
That is a silly question.
No.
Well, typically when you go into a mobile home park or you go into a park, they'll have some sort of 5 to 10 mile an hour, and then they have major speed bumps or something to remind you.
Sure, I get it, but I mean, I'm just looking at a hypothetical. I've seen some mobile home parks that have some pretty blind curves, and there are mobile homes that are blocking your view of oncoming traffic, and they could possibly, I think it could conceivably cause an accident if you don't have some sort of a posted speed limit. So
I can answer that for you, Leonard.
All right.
Motor vehicle standards or motor vehicle law can't be enforced on private land or on property.
Okay.
So hit 55 if you need to.
So,
all right.
I think all the residents are noted.
But I can't see by the way. No, but I can say that if a person is driving carelessly or with disregard to others or puts another person in danger for serious physical injury, it does kick into another similar criminal act and not necessarily driving.
All right. Okay.
And private property owners also have the ability to exclude people from their property for behavior.
Got it.
I always figured there'd be somebody out there at my car as soon as I stop. If I'm going too fast. Okay, so that's good.
Yeah, council alternative to remove the sections, so it's not really being applied.
Okay.
So back to the handout that I gave you this evening.
one that had all the pretty pictures from Google Street View. So we were on page 5. We're going to continue on and hopefully wrap up a couple items from last week. So on page 6, where it says motor vehicle parking table 4.6-2, you will find a clean version of the Planning Commission recommended table. So that's on these two pages. And then if you keep flipping to pages 8 and 9, our project team worked to, Council of Vanguard asked to simplify this table, so we took a go at that and have a new draft revised table that has worked to simplify from what the Planning Commission had recommended. And then on page 9, it walks through what has changed and how that simplification process went. So we were able to fit it onto a little bit less than one page, so that means that we're maybe moving in the right direction. Remove some uses, combine some uses, did some reformatting, just tried to simplify in a variety of ways. So take a moment to review that. If you have questions, we'd be happy to answer those, but we'd like to ask, is this a council alternative that you'd like to put out for comment? Are we heading in the right direction?
I'm really bummed you took the youth hostels out.
Well, they're there with those people. Mm-hmm.
Too bad.
What is 1 + 1? Right here, bed and breakfast.
Oh, yeah. So one space plus.
Okay. One
space
plus one for
each
guest room.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I shouldn't read far enough.
My question would be, where do Airbnbs come into this? Are they not considered bed and breakfast because they're not business per se? But.
So I can answer. Short-term rentals are not as separately regulated as under the development code right now, so it would fall under, if it fell under a bed and breakfast, if a person is operating under a licensing agreement with Airbnb and offering breakfast, it is a bed and breakfast. If they are not offering breakfast, then it depends on the number of rooms and how often they're being made available and could qualify as a boarding or rooming house. But short-term rentals are not specifically addressed in the development code, and so it depends on the characteristics of the way the property is being operated.
Okay, well, I need to look into that. Okay, so then my other question has to do with, at one time, we could only have rooming houses and boarding houses on a certain type of street, or is that still in the code?
Yes, so I know that we looked at that and there were some typo kind of clerical things that we updated in that section. Someone like 14 be willing to look into that piece.
Is there a reference next to boarding houses? Does it reference the section?
It says section 4.7.
Yeah. So that's where it talks about what street it has to be on.
What street it has to be on.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's unique to boarding houses,
okay,
where there's actual parking requirement contained in that section of code separate from the parking table.
Okay, so thank you. It looks a ton better. I like it quite a bit. So one sort of clarification. So when you look at manufacturing assembly, you have one space for each 1,000 square feet of gross floor area. But if you use warehouse commercial sales, you have one space for each 600 square feet of area. And when I think of warehouses, I think of them as a less dense use, even though they may require more parking spaces. And I don't know where that one.
So the warehouse sales that you're asking about, I can speak to this if you don't mind, Emma.
Okay.
But is really what would most likely fit in that is like a Costco.
Okay.
Where we're talking about warehouse commercial sales.
Like
Michael
sales.
Could talk to this too. Michael and I did a lot of the work, and others too, but we rely on some of the descriptions in the ITE manual, so do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, warehouse commercial, like you said, is like your larger big box. It's like you're showing up to buy really bulk items or your specialty kind of place, and you have this huge building, and then you're coming for, like, like a lumber store or things like that. It's different than your regular commercial or even your big box Walmart kind of commercial.
So. Got it. So when I saw that, I thought of like Crystal Valley on the Lake Bank, which is, doesn't have a lot of employees, but it's a huge building. You're saying it's more like Jerry's.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's just, it's a bigger one that finds a nice. So if you're looking at like manufacturing, warehousing, even warehousing probably has a lower required rate than what we have with manufacturing. And so with the other language that we have, we're allowed to look into IT for more of a specific land use in terms of that if they wanted to.
I'm good with it.
And just to point out, under the manufacturing and assembly use, if you look toward the bottom of that cell, it says warehousing. That is also one of 1,000.
Includes warehousing.
So, okay, so one is specifically like Jerry's. The other would be if I have a commercial and just store, having a distribution center.
Correct.
A
true warehouse. Yes.
Okay, yes. Perfect. Thank you.
We actually did change that number, the one manufacturing number. We didn't mess with any of the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that one, because we found it the difference was twice as much.
Yeah.
We were for manufacturing and assembly. If our requirement in the old table was 500, I think, let me just double check. Here, 1 to 500 for manufacturing and assembly. We changed that to 1,000 in that new draft table because we were requiring twice as much for industrial use.
Okay.
Which was based on the IT numbers.
And because we have all the options for reduction, this is the standard that you look to first, and then there's more flexibility.
Perfect. Thank you.
So I think it's going back to the Sony plant, is where it's a lot of personnel with a lot of assembly, a lot of staff. And so based on this standard, I mean, I think that could be where even the history behind that is, where you have assembly, and it's literally a lot of people in an assembly line. And if you have it just where it's 1 in 1,000, I don't think I would allow for enough parking for an assembly, actual assembly plant.
Manufacturing is all over the board in terms of how many employees per square foot. Some is very employee intensive, some is less employee intensive.
Right.
And so some of the extra language in here, the right size fit, to give that option, is there. We already had some language in there for manufacturing and heavy industrial, light industrial, that said you may reduce this number, which was 1 to 500 according to the number of employees on your largest shift, as long as you reserve extra space for that. So we had that larger number, but then we also had that code in there as well. We still have flexibility with the additional language that we've talked about to right size fit to the right kind of manufacturing, given the amount of employees that they say they are going to be having, as maybe some form of substantial evidence for the right size parking according to that, or using IT.
So, I mean, it seems like it would maybe be easier for you to just go to say, okay, how many thousands of square feet you have and how many average number of employees per 1,000 feet?
I'll just mention the one other thing we keep in the back of our minds is that then when that Sony plant changes use,
right, of course,
we want to make sure they don't develop too little parking that they can't change to a different, more intensive use later. So from a right-sizing standpoint, we're always thinking of the future reuse of a building when it's built up front as well. So we try and right, but
it worked. Didn't it?
Yeah. Thank you. I'm fine with this.
Is everybody else is fine? Looking for head nods. Okay.
Another council
alternative. I'm making progress. Amazing. Quit acting so shocked.
Well, I'm excited. I'm going to go to bed.
Dinner would be good.
Continuing on with the handout for this evening, where we have been looking at the parking tables, if you keep going one more page to page 10, there was a question about substantial evidence, and this was in relation to the parking reduction options and the exception language. So there's a little section here, but I'm going to turn it over to Christina to speak about this one, and then also your question about the ADA parking spaces in relation to the reduction. So Christina, would you like to walk through these two items?
Yeah, so I wasn't at the Planning Commission meeting last week. I was ill, but I did listen to the audio, so I think that I understand where the question was coming from. Somebody who reads substantial evidence and isn't an attorney, you're right, that isn't necessarily a very clear term, but it's similar to preponderance of the evidence. It's just the version of that, you know, preponderance of the evidence means more likely than not. That doesn't translate well into like, well, what's more likely than not when you're talking about a land use standard? So substantial evidence is what is used by Oregon courts to look at city land use decisions. And it means that it's evidence that a reasonable person would rely on in making a decision. It does not mean all the evidence weighs in favor of one or the other. Courts have said if there's overwhelming amount of evidence in favor of one result, that substantial, it doesn't need substantial evidence to go the other way, but essentially as long as it's reasonable. That does leave room for judgment. So there is some judgment. What's reasonable to me may be different than what's reasonable to another person. So, you know, acknowledging that. That there's judgment there, but there we do have an appeals process, and we try to build in some backbone for protecting people when there's judgment, so that judgment doesn't go, you know, haywire. But there are other potential ways to clean this up. What we were trying to do is leave it very flexible, and so in order to leave something very flexible, you end up, the trade-off is having less very clear and finite lists of evidence that we would accept. So that's something to think about. The trade-off is we could do away with that substantial evidence, we could rephrase it, and we've talked also internally about other ways to make this exception clearer so that it reads broken down into subparts so that it's a little bit easier to understand that way. That's something that we could work on. So there's room for improvement or for you to tell us further what you'd like to see.
Sure. I guess you want to keep this. Do you want to change it by reformatting to help clarify? Do you want to change it by reformatting and removing substantial evidence, but then that also reduces some of the flexibility that we're trying to provide to be responsive to developers? Those are the three options.
I'm going to vote for the substantial, although the minute you said it, I went, oh, no, that one's going to be one I'm going to be meeting with somebody over. I would vote for is having the flexibility. It's always the flexibility. I probably use that word more than anything else when I'm meeting with folks that are finding issues with trying to comply with the code, is how to have that flexibility and have it be able to be interpreted. So if that's wording that gives us that flexibility, that's what I would prefer.
Could you go through the other two options again?
Yeah, so keep it as is,
right,
which is a block of text and there's a lot of words there.
Right.
Two is to reformat but keep the same intent, just clean it up and have some sub-bullet points. Mm-hmm. And then three would be to do the reformatting with the sub-bullet points but not having the substantial evidence option, which kind of restricts the flexibility.
I just see a lot of wrangles and litigation coming out of this. I mean, I kind of opt for the reduced flexibility just on the grounds that we don't have to argue it and relitigate it every time that it comes up.
Joe. So I mean, I totally get what you're, you know, it's basically with the preponderance, more likely than not, 51% surety. There's all kinds of different ways to look at that. If you own 51% of the stock, you own the company. But, and I agree with the mayor, and it, substantial evidence sounds fine, and I get it. But it's more of a, to me, it's I like the word reasonable because there is mathematics behind reasonable standard. You know that, right? I mean, so you can test that with asking 25 people, and if 13 come up with the same answer, that's your standard. You know, which brings it to the 100 times 4. Anyway, so sorry, but you get what I'm saying. If it's a jury and you got 12 people on the jury, if 7 people agree with you, then that's reasonable. It's a reasonable action. And so how would you get to that, trying to get to that middle ground verbally without weighting it so far one direction or the other? And I guess the checks and balances would be that if there is a adverse decision, then it would trigger an automatic or the ability to easily look into it further for that flexibility. I don't know. I mean, there's so many different times where I've heard from developers that it's like they hear a decision and that's it. It's done. Not all the time, but I'm just saying it.
Yeah, so in this situation, it would be the developer bringing forward evidence making the case for further reducing the amount of parking that they need to build on their site.
Right.
So it's them pushing further if they wish to.
One thing, Mark and I did together work on an alternative that would break, it still used the word substantial evidence, but it broke it down into items. We didn't have it ready to bring to you tonight, even in the handout, but it's something that we could continue working on if you're comfortable with it. It would list out, you know, basically you can, the intent was, list out, you can reduce parking based on something that meets this list, and then the list would say, would try to give a little bit more clarity. ITE, you know, the current version of the ITE manual, which is in there, a parking generation study prepared by a licensed engineer with the scope of that's approved and advanced by the city, and then substantial evidence that less parking would be used, which, and then be more specific than what this currently says, which is site-specific characteristics or proximity to multimodal improvements, but being more, a little bit more specific than on what types of things that we're looking for, rather than being broader with site-specific characteristics.
Yeah.
So that's something that you'd be comfortable with us continuing to work on and bring back to you.
Makes sense to me.
We could also, instead of the word substantial evidence, which might read to a layperson as more scary, we could use a similar term, you know, reasonably likely, or...
Well, I mean, I'm okay with the word substantially, as long as the person's aware of really what that means, because it's not as quite as heavy as the, like you're saying, the impression is it's really a narrow area there in the middle, that when it gets that gray, that they don't throw their hands up and say, okay, I'm not going to do this project.
Sure. So, in this case where there is a decision to be made, who is making the decision? Is that left to the director of?
Mm-hmm.
So, is there any way in which if they didn't agree with the director, they could bring it to somebody else?
I think we would revise it to say the approval authority. So at whatever level the decision's being made, most often that's at the director level because these are director decisions, and then it's part of the normal appeal process up to the planning commission.
Okay.
In cases where this is being applied to something that's already being viewed by the planning commission, I think it would make sense for the planning commission to decide whether that evidence is reasonable or, you know, means that substantial evidence test, rather than you know, how it could literally be interpreted, which is the director would make some decision, tell the planning commission, the planning commission would decide on the application, but couldn't review that decision, and then that becomes very complex, needlessly complex.
Sean?
I'm for kind of bullying it out, kind of simplifying the language a little bit. I think I'm with Joe here, right? Like, the experience I want people to see is it's kind of that 51% standard. Like, if it ends up being substantial evidence or reasonably certain, I'm not as held up on the actual words, but that's what I want them to experience when they read the code.
Yeah.
And it's as close to being clear to someone as possible, because it is that kind of wording that throws people off every time that they get a hearing, or, you know, there's a decision made, that's when they're going to pick up the phone and call, because that isn't how they interpreted it. Okay.
Some homework on that one, I mean, as far as the wording, but...
We'll work on it. Thank you.
No, not good.
Lastly, the AD, I think this is the last one.
Yeah.
ADA related parking standards and the reduction for reducing parking at Dollar Tree. Let Christina speak to this one as well. Any questions?
So I provided the table from state law of what the parking requirements are, and then I thought it would maybe be best to explain this by way of an example of how this was adopted, the recommended code would work. So if somebody came in with a hypothetical parking configuration that would require 30 parking spaces under the table.
So you would look at their square footage or their number of employees, or whatever that is under the table, and it would require 30 parking spaces before any reductions. Then, if they were to apply one of the itemized lists of reductions that is referenced in that ADA language, which are the ones that are all capped at 20%, that's like bike parking, proximity to transit. It's not the catch-all exception where if you give us a parking study, you can reset the number. So it's like the itemized list. They come in with one of those itemized sort of guaranteed exceptions up to 20%. They reduce it 20% down to 24. They've gone from state law, from 2 ADA required spaces under state law, to 1 ADA space under state law. We would say, this recommended code would say, you still need to make 2 of your spaces ADA. So we're not changing the overall number of spaces that you've reduced down to. You can provide only 24, but 2 of those need to be ADA compliant. One of those would be van accessible, one could be generally ADA accessible. And that's the way that it would be applied in practice. So it would not alter the total number that they're able to take advantage of that reduction. It just wouldn't allow them to alter the number of ADA spaces.
So follow up with that then, with those, the ADA spaces, and especially the van accessible space requires 12 feet, I think, on the width, and so whatever that footage is. So if you're requiring 2 of them, which is typically equal to about 2.5 of your typical parking spaces, or maybe even 3, then that will also eat into total number of spaces made available, and how is that going to be compensated for?
So it would have I don't know if there's a difference between the van accessible space. I don't know. Van accessible spaces are larger. Every development up to 100 has to have one of their 80-day spaces be van accessible, and then no more in addition to that. So there would be no change in the fact that there has to be a van accessible space for any developments up to 100. Spaces. I don't know whether an ADA space, such as a general marked ADA space, differs in dimension from a general parking space. My understanding is not. So it would be a matter of the extra signage, except for, unless you had a difference between a wheelchair user only space and a van accessible space. My understanding is those dimensionally are equivalent, and it's just the sign. It's the sign posting. So in a van accessible space, It's anybody who has an ADA placard can park there, but in a wheelchair only, you need that special endorsement, but they're dimensionally equivalent is my understanding of that.
Yeah, the actual space is the same size. It's just the aisle width next to it.
So it's not going to require somebody to give more space for a parking lot than they would otherwise require until you get to parking lots that are on the order of 400 to 500 and above, where that's... It's more, maybe more space, but it's smaller.
I may not have worded that very good then. Is what I'm saying is, let's say you have a lot that you have just enough places, spaces for 20, or right. Okay, 25. So it kicks in the, so 25 spaces, and then we say, okay, well, they get their reductions and it kicks it down to 20, but we still require them to do the 2 spots, or I said, say it's the 30, let's say you started with 30. So they would typically require 2 ADA spots, and then they got the reductions based on street, et cetera. And so they by putting in the 2 spots, are they still going to be able to get an equal amount of vehicles, or it's going to be lessened?
It won't change the size or the number of spaces, because every parking lot under state law needs a van accessible ADA space.
Right.
So if you're changing, you're just making them sign one of the spaces that would otherwise just be open to anyone. You're making them add a sign for ADA and paint on the ground.
So just the one, the one spot is van, and the other spot can be normal size but signage.
Yes.
For
until
ADA.
You get to 400,
okay.
400
sorry.
Parking spaces and above, then you start needing more than
okay.
one van
I'm
space.
Sorry, I was picturing 2 van spaces, so my bad. Thank you very much for doing
Jeez.
That.
Hey. Okay. It took me a while working on this to wrap my head around all of it, so it's not
okay.
It's not just you.
So where are we at? So we have made it through great work with the street standards and the parking. We have a few action items to bring council alternatives back to you on those topics. We still have street network standards to talk about. So that's coming.
The map.
And then any other topics that you want to bring up before going to public hearing, we're happy to work on those with you as well. But I think we're making some great progress and going to public hearing in the foreseeable future at some point.
Very good work.
But that's all for tonight.
Yes, that is all for tonight. Thank you so much.